Well, thank you very much, Doug, and hi, everybody. Doug and I and Doug's wife, Marcia, had dinner last night, and I think Doug and I could say much crazier stuff about each other than now that Doug said about me. I want, before I start, to give a special shout-out to Mark Kellogg and the trombone choir. I have to yes. But I was thinking that if I could sound like that, what I would be up here, and God, I hope this isn't too antique a reference, pop music reference for some of the people here, I would be Barry White. I saw him speak once in my pop music days. He cleared his throat and people fell out of their chairs. So I am honored to be here. And I must say it goes beyond the honor that I think anybody would feel being asked to speak on an occasion like this at an institution like this. But I feel something very special because I've been teaching here for 3 years, of course, on the future of classical music as part of the Institute for Music Leadership. And I feel that in the 3 years, each year, something really special has happened in the course. There's been a real bond involving me and the students, and I think all of us, and I really include me, have learned a lot. So if my presence here is even in the smallest way any kind of acknowledgement about what those three classes were like, I am really deeply honored. Very special time in my life. So I'm going to talk about the future of classical music, which can be a scary subject, and I teach about it at Juilliard, too, and early in the course when I was giving all the statistical bad news, one of my students came in and said, oh, it's so depressing to go to your class. She said it with a smile. But so I'm going to spare you most of that, though I could tell stories. One of them, I will tell this. I was at a gathering of public radio music directors, about 15 of them from around the country. I was supposed to speak to them about the future of classical music. But one of them delivered a report on his own station and five others. And it seems like each year fewer people are listening. But the punchline is, he says, I think it's really good news because I thought it was going to be worse. The part of the statistics that I want to dwell on, though, for a moment, is the aging of the audience. And this is something that, on one hand, you know, it's conventional wisdom. Oh, everybody always says, oh, the graying of the audience, maybe it'll disappear. But on the other hand, you get a lot of people saying, it's not happening. The audience has always been this old. And the New York Times even published a big piece once in which they announced very positively that there were no demographic studies from the past to show that the audience had not always been the same age. Well, sorry. There are demographic studies. I'm uncovering them. I'm sure I'll find more. But I can tell you that when a major study of American orchestras was done in 1937, the age of the audience at various orchestras, median age 28, median age 33. In 1955, the Minneapolis Symphony, which is now the Minnesota Orchestra, did an extensive, thorough survey of its audience, and half of them were under 35. In 1966, a big foundation did a study of the performing arts, and the audience for all the performing arts, individually and together, median age 38. In 1982, the National Endowment for the Arts started studying the age of the classical music audience, and it's been aging from then until now. So this is a serious phenomenon, and the news that the audience was once 30 years old, this is striking. This is dramatic, and I think what it means is that quite a large cultural shift has gone on, and the best way I can describe it would be to give you three quick historical snapshots. Snapshot number one, 100 years ago approximately, I mean maybe 1890 into the 1920s. Okay, the Boston Pops Orchestra used to have college nights, and MIT students would form a long line and they would snake dance across the Charles River into wherever the Boston Pops played to see it. And Harvard students would come and they would make nuisances out of themselves demanding to hear the Brahms Academic Festival overture. This doesn't happen today. Geraldine Farrar, one of the leading stars of the Metropolitan Opera, was also a silent movie star, and she had a group of followers, teenagers and women in their 20s, who were called Jerry Flappers, who came to all her performances. E.M. Forster, in his famous novel, Howard's End, around the turn of the century, shows a very famous scene, a group of younger people in their teens and 20s, all at a performance of Beethoven's Fifth, their reactions described in great detail, as if this was the most ordinary part of life for them, which it would have been. And there was no competing form of music that could have been called serious in the West. And classical music was absolutely a living art, because here are some of the composers who were active in that time. Brahms, Tchaikovsky, Dvorak, Verdi, Puccini, Richard Strauss, Mahler, Stravinsky, Schoenberg, Webern and Berg, Ravel, Sibelius, Mascagni, Saint-Saëns, Rachmaninoff. In other words, the people who are now part of the classical canon, it was still being formed then, and those people were the composers whose new works everybody was listening to with no problem. Now, snapshot two. 50 years ago, again approximately, let's say, 1940 to 1960, there was still no competing form of music that the world at large called serious. If you said serious music, everybody knew you meant classical. But the music from that period that made an impression on the culture then and in the future was not classical, and I am not demeaning Shostakovich or Britten or Aaron Copland or Pierre Boulez or Elliot Carter or Leonard Bernstein or Samuel Barber, but this is a fact. The great musical names of that period, if you ask just about anybody who really knows the breadth of music, would be Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Duke Ellington, John Coltrane, musicals like South Pacific and West Side Story, Frank Sinatra, Pete Seeger, rock and roll. These were the musical phenomena that really made a difference back then. But classical music still had this phenomenal prestige and visibility. It was on network TV, if you can believe it. There was Virgil Thompson, the great composer and critic. He talked about an intellectual audience that he saw in New York at that time for certain very special performances. The New York Philharmonic, let's say, doing a concert performance of Berg's Wozzeck, which is a big event in 1952, suddenly there would be scholars and intellectuals and painters and playwrights and novelists and poets, and he said, women in peasant blouses, which I think meant the incipient radical folk music crowd. They would think this was important, and they had to be there. And there's also this lovely thing, which I'm going to quote from the violinist Hilary Hahn's blog from a movie she saw. I keep recalling a scene in a Yasha Heifetz movie in which the violinist, during a stop at a classroom at UCLA, gives a supposedly impromptu performance. As soon as Heifetz unpacks his instrument, a young woman slips out the side of the classroom to announce to students lazing on a lawn, her Hollywood voice projecting through cupped hands, Heifetz is playing a concert, free concert, everyone. Mr. Heifetz is giving a free concert inside, or something like that. The men wearing polished shoes and high-cinched belts, and the women clad in dainty heels, sweater sets, and pearls, leap from their seats. As Heifetz concludes his first piece, they dart into the hall and take their seats, awestruck and excited as children on Christmas morning. We should actually give a shout to Hillary, who is almost as good a writer as she is a violinist. Now, snapshot three is now. And obviously, you don't have people running into a building when they hear that Hillary is going to perform, with all respect to her. And you don't have classical music on network TV. You barely have it on public TV these days. But classical music still has this great kind of prestige, money, glamour about it, even though there's a sense that it's declining. There are, of course, vigorous efforts to stem that decline, new forms of concerts, outreach attempts, and a fascinating phenomenon, which, of course, you all, the graduates, you are examples of, no shortage of younger people studying classical music, even if you're going to go into an environment where you're going to be playing for people two and three times your age. Great phenomenon, a sign of hope. New music has probably never been in a better state, though I don't think works are being added to the canon particularly. And to me, the most interesting new music is outside the classical concert hall, new classical music. But, you know, the larger picture, classical music is simply swamped by popular culture, and popular culture, and this is the key point, has developed its own forms of serious art so that, in a certain sense, classical music, people can look at it and say, well, we don't really need that. It doesn't fulfill the purpose that it used to of being music's representative in the pantheon of art. So, consider this phenomenon, and it's very, very common. Let's take some really qualified intellectual. Let's take a graduate student in cultural theory who is reading really complicated stuff and knows who the latest painters are, reads the latest novelists, goes to art films. Musically, she's listening to alternative rock bands, the weirder, the better, and she has no knowledge of classical music and no interest in it at all. That's where Virgil Thompson's intellectual audience is now. And that kind of explains the aging of the audience. As the culture at large and classical music have moved apart, the people who still retain the most dedicated interest in classical music are the ones who grew up at the time when classical music was more central. Actually, the National Endowment has devastating numbers, sorry to depress you, about from 1982 to 1997, the percentage of the audience consisting of people under 30 fell in half. So, this is the part where things get better, things get less depressing. I think the bold initiative I want to propose is that we should do something to restore classical music to the role it had 100 years ago. And we can't do that in the sense that classical music will be the only art music. It isn't, it won't be, but it can take its place along everything in our culture that people pay more attention to: literature, visual art, serious film, jazz, the best pop music. Classical music should step up to the plate and really be a player in these things. And I think, you know, it's going to be your mission, and one of the ways you can do it is to be reaching people your own age. You hear a lot about outreach and education, certainly I do, and a lot of it is to kids in schools, and I'm not putting that down for a minute, but I think a great challenge is for you all to find an audience of your own age and to do it by building a bridge from your love of the music to what they think. Now, one little hurdle maybe to get over is that some people think the problem is the culture, that if classical music and the culture have moved apart, that's because the culture has degenerated. And I don't think so, and I will give one example. A distinguished gentleman in the arts gave a commencement speech a few years ago that circulated a lot on the internet, and he bemoaned the current state of things, and he loved thinking back in the 50s when he said, artists like Robert Merrill would sing opera on national television. Well, I love opera with all my heart, and Robert Merrill has a voice to die for, kind of like Barry White when he sings, but he didn't have a brain in his head. He's famous for that then, famous for that now for people who know it. And now we have people like Bruce Springsteen who not only sing music but write it. If you look at the DVD that came out with the 30th anniversary reissue of Born to Run, you see how seriously Springsteen puts his music together, what an artist he is in even the smallest details of layer after layer of tracks in the production. And he sings about serious stuff, the position of working class people in America today, and he thinks about that seriously. So fine, in 1954, we had Robert Merrill singing Lucia de Lammermoor on national TV, and now we have Bruce Springsteen on 60 Minutes talking very seriously about his social and political ideas. And I want to say, is that a step backwards? I don't know. Sounds like a step forwards to me. So, what do we do to change things around? Number one, we have to stop thinking we're better. We have to stop talking, as many people I love do, about our great art form. And we're just going to understand it is a great art form, but it's going to coexist with every other kind of music out there, which actually is what it does inside the heads of all of us. I mean, I say, Barry White, you all laugh. We all have this dual thing going on in our heads, and I think it just has to be acted out in the world. We have to get rid of the sense of entitlement. Classical music is special, fund it a lot, teach it in all the schools, generate an audience for it. Let's go out and just by our performances prove to the world how special we are. Get rid of the heavy burden of art. Now, if I say anything controversial today, maybe that would be the most controversial. Now, some people are going to say, oh my God, if you don't talk about art, you're saying classical music is the same thing as poor Britney Spears. But no, I don't say that at all. It's still perfectly possible to make distinctions, but when you put it up on a pedestal and you build a frame around it, and it's capital A art, then everybody starts saying, oh, I can't listen to this. Maybe I don't know enough. Maybe I'm not worthy. Maybe I'm not wearing the right shoes. I just say bring it before people and let it stand out in its natural power and glory. And then people will like it. Stop thinking that we need to educate people, that we have to teach them all the complexities of classical music. Think of my cultural theory graduate student. Are we really going to believe she's not listening to Tchaikovsky because it's too complicated for her, especially since the alternative rock she's listening to probably sounds more like contemporary classical music than it does like anything on the pop charts? I don't think that's a problem. I think people are barred from classical music for other reasons, not because they don't understand its complexities. Stop thinking that music education is the answer. It's a very unorthodox thing for me to say. But I think that even if we restored classical music education in every school tomorrow, it wouldn't even work. And the reason it wouldn't work is that the rest of the culture would still be there, and you get people like my niece Sarah, a college sophomore now. My sister is a professional violinist, or was. She made a career switch. My brother-in-law is a fabulous amateur pianist, plays chamber music all the time. Sarah studied the cello. And now she is an actor specializing in improvised stuff, and she does improvised jazz singing, and she thinks classical music isn't creative enough. So all those forces are going to still be there. It's like the Catholic Church. The Pope said, bring back the Catholic, the Latin Mass if you wanted to. The New York Times did a story. How is it going? Well, many parishes in America brought it back. Nobody came. And a sympathetic priest shook his head and said, you can bring back the Latin Mass, but you can't bring back the culture it was part of. And I think that's what happens if you suddenly institute, by some miracle, classical music education all over the schools. So, reach people your own age. And my wife, in her 40s, would say, people her age, too, because she thinks of her college roommate. She's a classical music critic for the Washington Post, and she would say, my college roommates aren't listening. Get them in. So how do you do this? And here is how I end, and I hope, a really positive note of hope. For one thing, the field is just full of new ideas and experimentation, so pay attention to them, try them out. Many of you I know are already doing that because students are really in the lead here. But look at all the performances that are taking place out of the concert hall in less formal places. I think it's good, although there is no financial model to say how anybody can make a living from it. But I assume that that will work itself out as the phenomenon grows. Notice that culture is actually moving our way. Look at the number of people, for example, downloading classical music online, much higher than the number who ever bought classical CDs in record stores when there were record stores. There is more openness to all styles of music than I have ever seen in my life, more curiosity about new forms of art, including music. And in New York, an amazing phenomenon has grown up, a kind of bond between classical music and alternative rock. A concert series that blends these things together can turn out 1,000 people to a concert of new classical orchestral music with no advertising. And WNYC, our public radio station, has changed its flagship classical music broadcast in the evening to be more than half works by living composers, something I never thought I would live to see. It suggests, by the way, that new music is going to be a central part of a future of classical music when we redevelop our younger audience. And finally, and this is really the key, build a bridge between your love of classical music and other people who don't know classical music yet. This is really the seed from which everything grows. And one way I've worked toward that in my courses both here and at Juilliard, and my students will remember this, I hope vividly because we had a lot of fun with it, is to ask students to make a presentation about a piece they play or a piece of their composer that they've written or a piece that they sing, personally and with a lot of feeling for people who don't know anything about classical music. And I want to give you an example, and I'm embarrassed to say it comes from Juilliard, but it's fresh in my mind. Somebody did this 2 weeks ago. He's a violinist. He has a string quartet. He wanted to talk about Beethoven's Opus 59, number 2. And this is his summary of what the piece is about. He says, first movement, Beethoven reveals himself for the first time as a full-fledged neurotic, a troubled, dramatic soul. Movement 2, transcendent grace. Skip over all of that. Find a place of beauty where there are no problems. Movement 3, pure cynicism. Beethoven's patron wanted a Russian folk tune. Beethoven gives it to him, says the student, as cheaply as possible, just to throw it at his face. Movement 4, the student says, just note spinning. Beethoven didn't have any ideas. He just wrote a movement that, to the student, doesn't mean anything. Now, he plays the piece and he loves it. And I'm not saying we all have to agree with this interpretation in any detail, in whole or in part, but if you're talking about a Beethoven string quartet that way, suddenly it becomes a human document that anybody can understand, coming from a recognizable human being who is living a recognizable kind of life. And then the real power that's in the music is going to be plain for everybody to hear. So finally, my last piece of advice, and this comes really from the bottom of my heart. Take this as an opportunity, number one, to play the music you want to play. To look into your hearts and say, what do I love about music? What do I want to do? How do I want to play it? Put aside the classical music rules a little bit. You want to be like my student from a few years ago, Justin Brown. He gave his graduation bassoon recital, all amplified arrangements of alternative rock songs. Or you could be like Simona Dinnerstein, the pianist who made an extraordinary recording of the Goldberg Variations in the last couple of years, which is utterly unlike any performance, but no synthesizers, nothing tricky, just straight piano playing, but so totally her that it's irresistible. And above all, don't think you can't make a difference. This is a time of tremendous change. Things are exploding all over the way. This is the cry of the new order being born. I love it. We're all learning from each other. We're all finding what's going to work in the new era. And if you look around, you find that as you try new things, you're part of a huge movement so big it has never been cataloged by anybody. But in my explorations of the music world, I see it happening in cities all over the country and all over the world. So when you try something new, even if you think for a moment that you're the only person doing it, you're part of something larger, and you might find that you are the spark or one of the sparks that is going to set classical music burning with a new, renewed, brighter light. Thanks.